Welcome back to the Jewish Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Moses Lappin, and today I'm joined by Professor David Beal to talk about his recent book, Hasidism, A New History, published in 2018 by Princeton University Press. Professor Beal is the Emanuel Ringelblum Distinguished Professor of Jewish History and the Director of the Jewish Studies Program at the University of California, Davis. He's the author of many acclaimed books, including Not in the Heavens, The Tradition of Jewish Secular Thought, also published by Princeton University Press, and a forthcoming biography of Gershon Scholem in the Jewish Lives series by the Yale University Press. The volume under discussion today, Hasidism, A New History, is the result of a monumental collaborative effort by seven scholars over the course of many years to compose a total history of Hasidism from its origins to the present day. The team included David Beal, David Asaf, Benjamin Brown, Uriel Gelman, Samuel Heilman, Moshe Rossman, Gadi Sagiv, and Marcion Wojcinski. As we'll discuss, Hasidism is a Jewish pietistic movement born in the mid-18th century that captured the hearts and minds of Eastern European Jewry and engendered significant opposition as well. Sourced in the Jewish mystical tradition and centered around charismatic local leaders, the movement formed and continues to form the intellectual ideology and daily lives of individuals and communities across the world. Our book today shows the ways in which this movement, in its many flavors, was fluid enough to adapt to distinct geographies and new social, cultural, and political problems. I enjoyed reading the book very much, and I'm happy to have Professor Beal with us today. Good morning, Professor Beal.
Good morning.
To begin, can you discuss with us a little bit about how you came to write the book? What was the intervention you intended to make? And what was it like working as a collaborative effort?
Yes. So back in the academic year 2007-08, there was a group at the Israel Institute for Advanced Study that on the subject of Hasidism. And some members of that group decided at the time that research had advanced sufficiently to make it possible to actually write a synthetic history of all of the history of Hasidism, something that had never been done. As I'll discuss in a moment. that group began to work, they needed someone who could sort of organize them, and that's how I came in. They drafted me as the project director. Hasidism is an area in which I had written several articles, but was not my main area of research. But I felt I knew just enough about it to be able to serve as project director. And during the course of the writing, I learned an enormous amount about Hasidism and feel very grateful for that. So what happened was I was of the opinion that what we ought to write was not a anthology of essays or an encyclopedia of Hasidism, but rather a history with one narrative voice, a history that would be written collectively because it was impossible for one person to write this history. There's so many different aspects geographically and in terms of the number of courts and so on. It required a team with people with expertise in different areas. And so my idea was that we were going to form a team, but the team was going to be actually a collective author. Now, how to do this? So this is my second idea, that the way you had to do it was to bring people to a place that wasn't their home. So they didn't have all the distractions of home, that was interesting, but not too interesting. As a result, I worked with the Simon Dubnow Institute in Leipzig to write a number of grant proposals, and we were funded for four summer residencies in the institute in Leipzig. By the way, Leipzig actually is very interesting, a wonderful place to work. So we spent four summers there, ranging between 2.5 to 4 weeks each time. and we basically worked together very intensively. We did an elaborate table of contents, and then we divided up the writing. But every chapter was almost immediately refereed by people on the same team. We divided ourselves into three teams, 18th, 19th, and 20th century. So everyone on each of those teams read everyone else's work, and there were a number of us who read the whole thing a number of times. So as a result, we were able to produce a book that is collectively authored as project director and sort of general editor, I rewrote the book several times. So it really does read as if it's one author rather than eight. So let me say a word now about the historiography and where we position ourselves on this book. So the first history of Hasidism was by Simon Dubnow, published in 1931. It was written in Hebrew, published simultaneously in German. Dubnow's history only goes to the year 1815. And in fact, the other histories that came subsequently, for example, Gershom Scholem's work on Hasidism, Hasidic thought, Martin Buber's work, and many others, almost all focused only on the 18th century because they believed that that was the creative period of Hasidic history. And they tended to view the 19th and 20th century as sort of degenerate forms of the movement. Now, as a result of the more recent research done primarily by people on our team, we believe that this is an inaccurate way of approaching Hasidism. Yes, of course, the 18th century was creative, particularly in terms of Hasidic thought, but the main features of the movement, which I will talk about later on, really develop in the 19th century. And so we regard the 19th century as a kind of golden age of Hasidism, not a period of degeneration. We also focus not only on Hasidic thought, which tended to be the focus of earlier histories. So we do treat Hasidic thought in great detail, but we also focus on the social history of the movement, the structural features, institutional features of Hasidism. So that gives you a sort of overall idea. If the 19th century was treated very sparingly by other earlier historians, the same could be said about the 20th century. And so we're also filling in an enormous gap there. Now, with all that said, there's still some areas that are under-researched and which we were not able to fully fill in. And of course, there'll be lots of work for future historians.
You open the volume with an introductory essay entitled Hasidism as a Modern Movement. And I was wondering if we can begin with this. What do you mean when you refer to it as modern? What does it mean that Hasidism is a movement?
Okay. So first of all, Hasidism presents itself and presented itself already in the latter part of the 19th century as a movement of resistance against modernization. And today it's certainly seen as, if you were to ask people what they think is the primary characteristic of Hasidism, they would say, well, this is a movement against modernity, a movement that is a throwback, is an attempt to preserve older tradition. Now, all that is true. Hasidism certainly has formed as a movement of resistance to modernity, but our argument is that that resistance is itself modern. Hasidism, the kind of social structure we find in Hasidism, the Rebbe or Tzaddik, the leader of the court, the very court system, which we'll talk about later, the followers who are dispersed widely geographically, who make pilgrimage to the court, all of these features of Hasidism on the from the point of view of its social institutions, all of that is new. Furthermore, the way in which Hasidism is chosen to resist modernity is using the tools of modernity, political organizing, political activism, lobbying. All of these activities, although they have some resemblance to earlier shtadlanut, intercession or lobbying that was characteristic of medieval, early modern Jewish communities, the way in which Hasidism goes about doing that actually is totally modern. So, in our view, Hasidism is a integral, essential part of modern Jewish history. It is not simply a throwback, because in many ways, Hasidism as it exists today is itself a kind of invention, a modern invention, some of it even invented after World War II. And in that sense, we call it not a movement of tradition, but a movement of traditionalism, that is, that attempts to argue for itself as the guardians of tradition, but that guardianship is itself new.
Before we take a look at the book in detail, can you give us a sense of the general ethos of Hasidism, its beliefs and practices, its rituals and institutions? In a sense, we could ask, what holds the different varieties of Hasidism together as one movement?
So this is an excellent question. And in fact, Hasidism does not form originally as a movement. That is part of our argument, actually. It only evolves into a movement gradually. And one of its characteristic, its central characteristic, really, I would say, is that it is a movement of movements. It's a movement that consists of many different leaders, many different courts, many different groups of followers, and so that in a sense there is no central institution of Hasidism where one can point to it and say, okay, these are the characteristics both of the structure and thought. With that said, the fact that it is a fragmentary movement or a movement of movements, there are some common features. I've already alluded to the institution of the Rebbe or the Tzaddik, his court, his followers, the rituals of pilgrimage to the court. These are characteristics that begin to form in the latter part of the 18th century. They're not necessarily there originally, but they do form later on. In terms of Hasidic thought or teaching, the individual who is thought by the Hasidim, and indeed by most historians to be the founder of Hasidism, Israel Baal Shem Tov, a figure who lived between about the year 1700 and died in 1760, the Baal Shem Tov emerged out of a prior movement of piety, also called Hasidism. We say Hasidism with a small h instead of a capital H. This movement of piety was characterized by figures who pursued a kind of very ascetic lifestyle, self-mortification, penances for sins. These people also, some of them practiced magic. They were called Baal Shem, people who could manipulate the divine name. And Israel Baal Shem Tov, as his name, his title or nickname suggests, was himself part of that movement of earlier Hasidism with a small h. But he deviated from it in an important way. He rejected the penances, the asceticism of his milieu, and argued instead, as he wrote in an important letter to one of his followers or companions, Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy, that one should worship God with joy rather than in sadness. This is a very, very important feature of the movement starting at its very origins. And this leads to practices, rituals of prayer that involve song and dance. These are two features of Hasidism, which contemporaries already noted in the late 18th century and continue to this day. With all that said, though, we cannot state that particular teaching of the Baal Shem Tov was necessarily adopted by all Hasidic leaders after him. For example, the Maggid of Mezrich, Dov Ber, one of the companions of the Besht, who goes on to found a kind of a court of his own and had disciples who go out and actually create the movement after his death. He was a pretty ascetic leader, and his views actually depart from those of the Baal Shem Tov on this matter. And we find in later Hasidic history others who are much more ascetical than in the case of the Baal Shem Tov. Now, there's one other feature of Hasidic thought. I mean, there are many features, but this, I think, is a central one, and that is God's immanence, that God is to be found everywhere in the world, and that one can worship God through everyday acts, like eating and drinking, even as one famous story says, one goes to the Rebbe to watch how he ties his shoes. So these everyday acts are filled with potential divinity. And this also is a very important teaching of Hasidism. It draws upon earlier Kabbalah, earlier Jewish mysticism, but it is now popularized, made a kind of feature of the popular, of the mass character of the movement. So these would be some of the features I would emphasize in terms of Hasidic ethos, as we call it, or thought.
Could you give us a sense of the periodization of the movement, its origins, and then its the creation of the court and a movement as a whole, and then, as you talk about in the book, its institutionalization and the variations of Hasidism, all the way to its sort of death during the Holocaust and rebirth afterwards?
Yes. So one of the arguments of our book, it's an argument that has been made by several historians, including some members of our team in earlier work, is that the Baal Shem Tov actually did not set out to found a movement. He had, I'm using the term companions, people who gathered around him in a kind of circle. These people were not necessarily disciples in the way we think of later. The term Hasid, by the way, comes to mean disciple. Its original meaning being pious, a pious person, but it acquires a secondary meaning of a disciple of, a Hasid of. So he does not set out to found a movement. Those of his companions who outlive him, such as Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezrich, probably also do not see themselves as part of a movement. In 1772, the year that Dov Ber dies, there is the first manifestations of opposition to Hasidism. This is a subject that is also interesting unto itself. Why did it arouse opposition? In any case, this opposition is led by Elijah, the Gaon of Vilna, the preeminent rabbinic authority of the age. It is entirely possible that this is one reason Hasidism begins to think of itself as a movement. In other words, the fact that it has engendered opposition means that the Hasidic leaders need to think of themselves as maybe representing something that unified that is being opposed. And the Magid of Mezrich, a half year before his death, convenes in Rovna a meeting of some of his primary disciples to figure out how to oppose the opposition, how to counter the opposition to Hasidism. And this may be the first point at which people begin to think of themselves as constituting a part of a movement. Later on, it's quite a bit of time later, I would say, maybe even in the early 18th century, that the Baal Shem Tov is seen as a founder. And there are legends that emerge and are finally written down and published in 1814 of the Baal Shem Tov as a founder of the movement. And in order to have a movement, you need a founder. And so the Baal Shem Tov comes to fill that that role. So the growth of the movement actually is very slow, we think, in the latter part of the last quarter of the 18th century. The institutions of Hasidism, I would call them a kind of proto-courts. They are not yet full-blown courts. But they're beginning to form in that direction. The Maggid is actually the first to hold a kind of court. Jewish Enlightenment thinker Solomon Maimon visits the court of the Maggid, and he writes in his autobiography of that experience. So there's clearly something already starting at that point. But the full blown institutions of Hasidism really are in the early 19th century. And it's at that point that you get courts that are, in some cases, very opulent, very ramified in terms of the physical structures, the many different functionaries of the court, the pilgrimage, mass pilgrimage to the court. All of this is there in kind of in Nuche in the late 18th century, but really, really flowers and develops in the 19th century. And so this is one of the reasons that we see the 19th century as the golden age. This is the point at which Hasidism becomes a mass movement. It's entirely possible in the late 18th century that most Jews of Eastern Europe have not even heard of Hasidism. They have also probably not heard of the opposition to Hasidism, because the opposition, if you take a look at it, only really exists in about three places, in the town of Brody, Shklov, and Vilna, the city of Vilna. In the 18th century, the vast majority of Jews are probably ignorant of Hasidism and ignorant of the conflict with its opponents. In the 19th century, interestingly, the movement of opposition basically fades away. Its place is taken by the new Jewish Enlightenment, which sees Hasidism as a kind of an enemy, because it represents to them the most superstitious, backward, medieval aspect of Jewish society. It's in the 19th century that Hasidism now begins to really win followers on a mass scale. How many? Hard to say. We think that in the areas where Hasidism is particularly active, that maybe 30 to 40% of the Jewish community by around 1850 affiliates in some form or the other with Hasidism. I put it that way because you're not given a membership card. And so how does one determine who is a Hasid? Someone who makes pilgrimage to the court, for sure. But there were people who were not Hasidim who went to the court, including Christians. So it's a little bit hard to define in the 19th century, but it does become a movement that wins mass following in various areas of Eastern Europe. Now, Hasidism falls on hard times by the end of the 19th century, mainly because of the impoverishment of the Jews of Eastern Europe, especially in the Russian Empire. And so these opulent regal courts, as we call them, are not able to sustain themselves any longer. In World War I, the war has a terrible effect on the Jews of Eastern Europe. We generally know about the Western Front, trench warfare, but on the Eastern Front, civilian population suffered terribly. And this includes the Jews and certainly the Hasidim. And so one of the consequences of this was something that we didn't see much before, and that is relocation of Hasidism to cities. Hasidism becomes now for the first time an urban phenomenon. Courts move to Vienna, to Warsaw. So when we come to the interwar period, Hasidism has a somewhat different profile. Of course, it's still out in the shtetlach, in the small towns, but it is now more of an urban phenomenon. But the interwar period is itself a period of tremendous stress. After the Bolshevik Revolution, the Hasidic groups who are dominant in Russia, Chabad, Chernobyl, Bratislava. These movements have to either flee or go underground because of the religious persecution of the communist authorities. In Poland, which is where Hasidism continues to flourish, there are still enormous stresses. The Polish Jews of the interwar period are undergoing a process of secularization, modernization, politicization. People abandon religion and embrace new political ideologies like communism, Bundism, Zionism. And so Hasidism is now losing losing followers. It feels itself very much under stress. And then comes the Holocaust, which, although it's impossible to give numbers, there's no question that the vast, vast majority of Hasidim are murdered by the Nazis. And then after the war, one would have thought that this movement was, for all intents and purposes, finished. And yet we find a remarkable resurgence, renaissance of Hasidism in the post-war period, to the point where a movement that probably came out of the war with only a few thousand survivors is today, in our estimation, a movement of some 700,000 people, which is astonishing growth. Initially, the growth was through recruitment among other Orthodox Jews who were not necessarily Hasidim before the war, but increasingly, of course, it's a result of natural growth, of high fertility rate, 10 to 15 children per family. So Hasidism, and of course, in the post-war period, we enter into an entirely new age in terms of where the Hasidim live. They're no longer in Eastern Europe. They are now primarily in North America and Israel. And that's a whole story that we can perhaps talk about in a bit.
Before we unpack the larger themes of the book, I would like to turn to the book itself now. And as you mentioned, it's structured chronologically in three main sections, the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, that include these sort of thematic tangents. I would like to now ask you some questions about geographies, personalities, and some of the dynasties of Hasidism to give a sense of the locality and the variation of the movement over time. So let's begin in the 18th century, where the book begins, with the mythological founder of Hasidism, Israel Baal Shem Tov, and his student, who, as you argue in your book, would become, in a sense, the architect of the movement, the man who would be known as the Maggid of Mezrich. Who were they? What were their beliefs, and what were their contributions to the movement?
Yeah, so I've already talked about the Besht, or Israel Baal Shem Tov, and his primary ideas. I would say that the Maggid actually is a very interesting figure. He has absorbed the Neoplatonic ideas of Kabbalism. It's a much more philosophical approach to these ideas in his writings. He didn't really write anything, but like in most Hasidic books, his teachings were oral, and they were written down by actually one of his students and published later. That, by the way, is an interesting subject, the Hasidic book. Even though the movement is in many ways an oral movement, a movement of sermons, of oral teachings, the Hasidic book begins, first Hasidic book, 1781, and we already have in the that decade and the next decade a remarkable library that accompanies the oral teachings. Now, the Maggid, I don't want to give the impression that the Maggid is the architect of the movement, as you put it. Yes, he is very, very important, and his students, Avraham of Kalich, Avraham of Trisk, Shneur Zalman of Liadi, his youngest disciple, Levi Yitzchak of Berdicha, these are very important figures, to be sure, in the later movement. And yet there are also other figures who are not part of his circle, who go off and develop their own circles of Hasidism. And so it's important to Aaron of Carlin, for example, is one of those. So the movement actually, I mean, one can actually use a kind of network theory to explain the spread of the movement. It doesn't spread from one center necessarily. As important as Mezrich was to the later movement, there are other centers, there are other networks, one cannot generalize, therefore, about Hasidism in this period. So I want to talk for a moment about Shneur Zalman, because he's a very important figure, not only in terms of his own movement, but in terms of the later social structure of Hasidism. So Shneur Zalman, the youngest disciple of the Magid of Mezrich, is from Belarus, near Lithuania. He begins to attract followers in the 1780s and 90s. He develops a court system of his own, but in his case, he doesn't actually like to receive followers. And he develops as an alternative, a system of emissaries, shluchim, they're called in Chabad. The term still exists today. It refers to missionaries who go out all over the world and try to convert Jews into followers of Chabad. But he does this because he feels inundated with pilgrims, and he sends out these emissaries to bring his teachings and his instructions, not just theoretical teachings, but instructions about practices, rituals. And so this creates a different kind of network, a network in which the movement can exist without constant pilgrimage to the leader. And consequently, Chabad actually is one of the most geographically dispersed movements in the northern part of the Pale of Settlement in Russia. And it's because of that that in the late 19th century, well, actually even in the mid-19th century, leaders of Chabad are seen by the Russian government as leaders of Hasidism altogether, and even leaders of the Jewish community in general. So he's very important. Chabad also, when he dies, 1812, Chabad forms a dynasty. So there's struggle over this, but nevertheless, the dynastic principle becomes central to Chabad. It will also be central to other Hasidic groups, but Chabad is maybe the earliest to establish it in a very strong way. And that dynastic principle is what is going to define Hasidism largely in the 19th century. So I know you wanted to ask about specific areas. If we move to the 19th century, well, let me go back to the 18th century to give some sense of geography here. So the cradle of Hasidism is in the southeastern corner of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, Podolia, and to some degree Volhynia. And it spreads very gradually in the 18th century to the north, that's where Shneur Zalman is, Belarus. There are some outposts in Poland as well. But it is primarily located in the southeastern area. In the 19th century, though, we have a spread of Hasidism that is quite different. It spreads in the Russian areas of the Pale of Settlement, further to the north and elsewhere, but it primarily spreads to the northwest. It spreads into the area of Poland that is taken over by the Austrian Empire, an area called Galicia. It spreads into what is called Central Poland or Congress Poland. To define these terms, I'd have to go into a whole history lesson. But these are the areas of Poland that are partially self-governing under the Russian Empire. And so we get areas that where Hasidism was pretty much, you know, only barely existent in the 18th century, now become actually the centers of Hasidism in the 19th century. So that geographical spread is very important. And each of these areas develops somewhat different characteristics in terms of the forms of Hasidism.
Another fascinating figure that you write about in the volume is the figure of Nachman of Bratslav. Could you tell us a little bit about him and about his beliefs and the Hasidus of Bratslav?
So Bratslav is, of course, very known today for a couple of reasons. First of all, there are a number of historians of Hasidism who have written very passionately about the thought of Nachman of Bratslav, which was an extraordinarily interesting and unusual thought. People like Arthur Green, who has actually wrote the afterword to our book. So Nachman has become a kind of a very popular thinker among people who are not necessarily Hasidim themselves, but are fascinated by Hasidism, Jewish people in the Jewish Renewal Movement. Nachman is seen as a kind of an existentialist Hasidic thinker. Green has compared him to the Protestant religious existentialist Soren Kierkegaard, and he has a great resonance in modernity. This interest in Nachman actually starts with Martin Buber, whose first book on Hasidism, 1906, was The Tales of Rabbi Nachman. And so Nachman has this kind of cachet. The other reason that Bratslav is seen today as a kind of central part of Hasidism is it's become a kind of a movement of its own in the last couple of decades. A Bratslav tradition is to make pilgrimage on Rosh Hashanah, on Jewish New Year, to Uman in Ukraine, to where he is buried. In other words, pilgrimage to his grave. And that pilgrimage was impossible under the Soviet Union. Once communism fell, it became possible. And that pilgrimage now is a mass phenomenon. Some 30 or 40,000 people come there every year. Who are these people? Well, some of them have affiliated with Bratslav. Some of them are fellow travelers. Some of them are just along for the ride for the sex and drugs, according to some reports. But most of them are there for a spiritual experience. And yet what's fascinating is this become a mass phenomenon. Now, so you would get the impression from these two rather recent developments that Bratslav is a really important movement in Hasidism. But in fact, Bratslav historically was tiny. Nachman himself, who died in 1810, had a circle of followers, a very small circle, it seems. It was seen in his day as a deviant form of Hasidism, as bizarre, with bizarre practices like going into the woods and screaming as you prayed to God. In the 19th century, Bratslav, which continued to flourish in very, very small numbers, was persecuted by other Hasidic groups because the Bratslav Hasidim continue to revere Nachman as their leader, and they do not have a dynasty. His son died in 1806. Because he had no successor, the Bratslav Hasidim were called the Toita Hasidim, which means the dead Hasidim, the Hasidim who worship a dead leader. And they were persecuted, even sometimes, you know, with violence. So they persist in tiny groups with leaders who are not rebbes, who are kind of people who carry on Bratslav traditions, manuscripts that are and sayings and teachings that are said to go back to Rabbi Nachman. This is a movement, again, in a way, it's a kind of microcosm of Hasidism when we come to the 20th century, essentially destroyed in the interwar period with Bolshevism. They reestablished their pilgrimage to the city of Lublin in eastern Poland because they're not able to go to Uman. Many of them die in the Holocaust. And yet here we have them resurrected, as it were, as an extraordinarily vital movement.
If we move to the 19th century, one of the fascinating figures your book covers is Rabbi Israel Friedman of Ruzhin. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about him.
So Israel Ruzhin, a descendant of the Magid of Mezrich, establishes a court in the 18 teens, and he's very, very different. He does not claim to be learned in any sense. He does not use Kabbalah as the foundation for his teachings, which had been the case for many of the 18th century teachers. He now sets a different course, which we will find among many Hasidic leaders in the 19th century, namely Kabbalah becomes less and less important in their teachings. In the case of Israel of Ruzhin, it is virtually absent. He is a kind of pastoral figure. That is, he is seen as someone who gives spiritual comfort and support to his followers, but not with some kind of profound or esoteric teachings. Israel of Ruzhin develops the regal court. He's one of the first to develop this type of court, which is to say a very opulent court with many buildings and where the experience of pilgrimage is an experience of entering into the domain of someone who is like Jewish aristocracy. Israel is accused of being involved in the murder of two informers in the late 1830s. He's in prison for a while. And he then flees across the border to the Austrian part of Eastern Europe, the Galicia, reestablishes his court, which had been in Ruzhin, which is in Russia, reestablishes it in the town of Sadagora. And from there, his descendants establish a network of courts in a number of different places. And this becomes a very, very important branch of 19th century Hasidism. these people, these leaders, flee to Vienna during World War I. And then some of them from there go to Palestine, some to the United States. This very, very important movement, the Ruzhin-Sadagora dynasty, it still exists, but it no longer has the same kind of numerical weight that it had in the 19th century.
If we transition from maybe discussing individual charismatic leaders to discussing some of the dynasties or movements in general, one of the dynasties that plays a large role in your narrative during the 19th century is that of the Belz Hasidim. So I was wondering if you can tell us what makes them distinctive and a little bit about their thought and history.
Yeah, so Belz is established somewhere around 1815 or so, Shalom Rokeach of Belz. This is a purely 19th century Hasidic group. And it is distinguished actually by quite, one might even say fanatical adherence to not only Jewish law. All Hasidic groups are followers of Jewish law, but also customs. And it is seen as one of the most conservative of the Hasidic groups. It has a major influence on the development of Hasidism in Hungary in the 19th century. This is a Hasidism that also is frequently seen as very, very strict in terms of both custom and law. And I think that we describe the wedding of a son from the Chernobyl dynasty in Russia and a daughter from Belts, and how odd he found the family and the of his of his wife and the all the customs that they practiced. This was something very foreign to him. And this gives you a very good sense of the fact that just because you're a Hasid doesn't mean that all Hasidic groups are alike. And some of their practices may seem very, very odd and foreign. And one finds that in this account of this Chernobyl Hasid with his wedding, wedding in Belts. Belts, by the way, the Rebbe of Belts actually survives the Holocaust. He flees with his brother-in-law into Hungary. And from Hungary, he's able to go to Palestine in 1944. And so he reestablishes Belts in the state of Israel, well, Palestine, actually, before the state of Israel. And interestingly, Belts, although it has this very, very conservative history, is actually seen in the state of Israel today among the different Hasidic groups as a Hasidism that is most open and accepting of the state. Because other Hasidic groups, like Satmar, for example, reject the state altogether. Belts is a little bit more open. But Belts is also reestablished. It was also a kind of regal Hasidism in the 19th century. And relatively recently, they have built a synagogue, which is a replica of what existed in the 19th century, which may be the largest synagogue in the state of Israel.
If we can take a tangent for a moment, one of the things that sort of is an overarching theme in many sections of the book, and you touch on in different geographies and with regards to different dynasties, is the relationship of women to the Hasidic court and Hasidic ideas, and as well as the unique role of the family in Hasidism. So I was wondering if you can reflect on that a little bit. What is the role of women in Hasidism, and what does the family look like?
A fascinating subject. In the 18th century, Hasidism modeled itself on a traditional Jewish or institution within the Jewish community called the Chevra, a usually translated confraternity, like the Chevra Kadisha. In other words, a group that came together for a particular purpose. It could be to perform the mitzvah of burial, or it could be just as a study Chevra. The Hasidic groups in the local communities, that is not where the Rebbe was necessarily, but local communities, Hasidim would have their own prayer house called the Shtibel, and they formed themselves as a Chevra. Now, Chevras never include women. So it was more or less a given that in its origins, Hasidism is not is a purely male movement. When we get to the 19th century, the picture changes somewhat, but not that much. Women begin to make pilgrimage to the court to ask for, intercession on their behalf in childbirth and illness and so forth. But that does not mean that women are really Hasidim or Hasidot would be the proper grammatical form. It is likely that Hasidism is still seen as a male movement We have a wonderful picture done by a French artist who came through Eastern Europe in the mid-19th century and drew pictures of Jews. And he draws a picture of a, what he says, a Hasid and his wife, not a Hasid and a Hasidah. So in the 19th century, the Hasidic family is a, yes, they probably follow certain practices, maybe even certain food ways that are characteristic of their Hasidic group. And in that sense, the Hasidic family is partaking in Hasidism. Some of the particular practices or customs that are true for a Hasidic group, like how you wash your hands before the meal, those probably were practiced on the family level. But it's probably not correct to say that women were a part of the Hasidic movement. This changes in the 20th century, probably mostly after World War II. Chabad plays an important role in this because the seventh Rebbe of Chabad, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who is not able to have children, makes women into a very, very central part of his mission. He had a messianic kind of outlook, and he drafted women into central roles in bringing the Messiah. People in New York will recall that when he was still alive, the bottom, very bottom of the front page of the New York Times, in tiny letters every Friday, would say, "Jewish women and girls light Shabbat candles." This was part of his messianic campaign. So women become very important. And today, when Chabad sends out their shluchim, their emissaries, they are invariably married. They are accompanied by their wives, who play, I would say, a pretty much equal role to the men in their activities. But even in other groups, I think women have become, now do see themselves very much as Hasidim. We had an interesting debate in our group. This gives you a sense of the inner workings of the group. One member of our 20th century team said, women are not Hasidim, even today. Another member of our group, the sociologist Sam Heilman, said, yes, they are. Well, how to settle this dispute? Well, Sam is very well connected with various Hasidic courts. So he sends an email to the Gabbai of the Mundkatscher Rebbe. Now, they're not supposed to be on the internet, but they're all on the internet. And he sends him the question, are women Hasidim? The answer comes back 30 seconds later, yes. So I think that, I don't know if that really establishes it for all Hasidic courts, and it may be actually when women come to the Rebbe to ask for something, in some cases they're not allowed to have a one-on-one audience. They have to pass their request through the Gabbai, through the assistant. But I think women have now become very much a part of Hasidim, Hasidism, and they identify as such, not just as Hasidot generally, but the Hasidah of the Mundkatscher Rebbe or the Hasidah of the Belzer Rebbe and so forth.
Another fascinating Hasidut in the 19th century is that of the Kotzkers, of Menachem Mendel Morgenstern of Kotzk, and the various groups that arose from him, from his students. Could you tell us a little bit about this story?
Yes. So Menachem Mendel of Kotzk was a very unusual leader. He was extremely demanding of his followers, very harsh. And he secluded himself for many, many years and wouldn't meet with them at all, followed an extremely ascetic kind of lifestyle. And he represents the sort of one of the sort of ascetic poles of Hasidism. We spoke of the Baal Shem Tov earlier, of, you know, the worship God through the material world. Well, the Kotzker is really on the other end of the spectrum. He had several disciples, and they went off to found their own groups. One of the groups is Izbitz. Their leader is a kind of a, he propounds a kind of doctrine, which has become rather attractive to modern Jews, because it looks like it's antinomian. That is, that everything that God wills is true and correct. And so if God wills you to violate the commandments, that too is a somehow endorsed by God. Now, this is probably an incorrect modern interpretation of his teachings, which were never intended to be antinomian. And yet there's something really interesting there, appealing, just like Bratzlav, to modern people. But his Hasidism was kind of very small. Much more significant in terms of numbers was Ger. The Ger Hasidim become, certainly by the interwar period, the largest Hasidic group in interwar Poland. Their Rebbe is able to flee in 1940 to Palestine, and he reestablishes Ger there. It is now, I believe, probably either the largest or maybe the second largest in Israel. And actually, in the post-war period, Ger, which is a quite down-to-earth, worldly movement, develops a kind of very ascetic practices of its own, the so-called holiness regulations, in which Ger men are not supposed to ever address their wives by their first names, by their names at all. They're not supposed to look into each other's eyes. The wife is supposed to follow her husband behind him. They must only have sexual relations once a month. It's a very extreme kind of sexual asceticism that one doesn't really see in earlier Hasidism. There are a couple of other Hasidic groups that have gone this route as well. And this is a interesting turn in Ger. Why is a subject for speculation, why this developed in post-war Israel, but it did, possibly to distinguish themselves from other Hasidic groups and partly as a way of distinguishing themselves from the secular Jewish state.
On that note, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what's attractive to Hasidism. It seems like it's a large movement that gains followers and keeps its followers together. How does it keep people engaged? What's attractive about it?
Well, the leadership, the Rebbes, are generally speaking, not always, charismatic figures. Figures who attract because of their spiritual sort of aura. Sometimes that aura is attached to a dynasty. In other words, the present, you know, holder of the dynasty may not himself be charismatic, but the dynasty as such has acquired a kind of mystical aura. And I think that's one of the features, important features. The other feature is that it creates a sense of community across space, but actually across both time and space. You are connected with every other Chabad Chassid around the world. You may come together when you make pilgrimage to the court, and it creates this sense of identity and attachment that is, I think, especially in a world that is now global, it creates the sense of a global community. So these are, I think, two of the features that make Hasidism attractive.
And what do you think the opposition to Hasidism is, from its origins until the modern day? There have been many types of opposition to it. Why do you think it causes this kind of resistance?
Well, in the 18th century, Hasidism was the resistance, as I indicated earlier, was actually quite sporadic and local. It was seen in Jewish history as a widespread movement of opposition. That's almost certainly untrue. When the Gaon of Vilna dies, he in the 1790s, the opposition more or less vanishes. It is then, as I said earlier, the place of this rabbinic opposition to Hasidism is taken by the Jewish Enlightenment, which sees Hasidism as it begins to see itself as a movement of resistance to modernity. So in the 19th century, there is quite a bit of this kind of modern enlightened opposition. Although even there, one must be careful because the Jewish Enlightenment in Eastern Europe is a relatively small movement for most of the 19th century. We think of it as a major movement because they produced books, but you know, we're talking about hundreds or maybe in the low thousands of adherents. It's only when secularization and modernization really set in Eastern Europe in the latter part of the 19th century that opposition to Hasidism becomes a more widespread phenomenon. And then what happens, interestingly, is that in the early 20th century, this opposition, such as it is accompanied by a neo-Hasidic movement. People like Martin Buber, the Hebrew writer Michal Yosef Berdichevsky, the Yiddish writer Yud Lamed Peretz. These figures now become nostalgic for Hasidism. They reject the Hasidism they see around them as degenerate, but they go back to the 18th century and see something there that can furnish a secular Jewish renewal in the 20th century. And I think we see that today as well. The movement of Jewish renewal draws inspiration from how it sees Hasidism, sometimes ahistorically. But Hasidism continues to exert an extraordinary fascination. Maybe just to conclude with this, one of the things that struck us since the publication of the book, we've had a number of public events. One, out of all places, the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and it was sold out. 160 people showed up for it. None of them was a Hasid, by the way. We had an event in Berkeley, usually seen as a bastion of secular left-wing Jews, but we had 100 people show up. Fascination with this subject. This is a, I think itself a very interesting subject. The modern fascination with this movement.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I guess I'd like to conclude with the third section of the book and briefly cover some of the topics you talk about there, and that's Hasidism in the 20th century. There are a number of dynasties that you cover more heavily in the 20th century. We began to talk a little bit about Ger earlier, about the Kotzker Rebbe. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the dynasties of Ger and that of Slonim as well.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that Ger has developed these Kedusha or holiness regulations. And that is one of the ways in which they distinguish themselves from other Hasidic groups. It's really interesting. The studies that have been done of Ger, sociological studies, you would think that because of these regulations that women would be, you know, feel themselves oppressed, but they don't, actually. The women of Ger are among the most active in the secular world in terms of, working outside the home. It's an interesting, I mean, I don't know what the connection is between the Kedusha and that particular phenomenon. Ger in interwar Poland was a very worldly movement. The Rebbe was a important political figure. This is something we haven't spoken of, that there are a number of Hasidic leaders in both the 19th and 20th century who have been politically very, very active. Yitzhak Wurka in the 19th century in central Poland was a very important figure who was seen by the government as a kind of speaking for the Jews as a whole. Shalom Dovber Schneerson at the end of the 19th century, the fifth Chabad Rebbe, also seen by the Russian government as a central leader. And in the interwar period, the leaders of Ger fulfilled that role. In the post-war period, Ger is quite active politically in Israel. So is Belz, because these are two groups that don't entirely reject the state. They're willing to support political parties like the Agudat Yisrael or Degel Torah, depending on the period, that are ultra-Orthodox parties, but they take part in, at least to some degree, in the government in certain instances. So those groups are very important. But the other group that's very important and emerges, it starts in the interwar period, we haven't spoken of them, is Satmar. So Satmar is a new dynasty. It's founded by Yoel or Yoelish Teitelbaum. His older brother is the Rebbe in Siget. And in those days, if you wanted to found a new dynasty, you had to go elsewhere. And so he migrates to Satmar, the town of Satmar, Satmaru, in Transylvania. And he is a part of the sort of very extreme ultra-Orthodoxy of Hungary between the wars, a ultra-Orthodoxy led by the Rebbe of Munkács. And this is a ultra-Orthodoxy that opposes Zionism tooth and nail. After the war, of course, ironically, the Satmar Rebbe is saved by the Zionists in the famous train of Rudolf Kassner in 1944. So he survives, and he then comes to New York, where he rebuilds his movement, basically from scratch, and creates the largest Hasidic group in the world today is Satmar. Headquarters is in now in two places in New York. They have a township in upstate New York called Kiryas Yoel. They're also in Williamsburg. He was very astute. He told his followers to buy real estate in Brooklyn after the war when it was dirt cheap. And as a result, they control a lot of New York real estate, Brooklyn real estate, to be more precise. And he is a adamant opponent of Zionism. He will not cooperate with the state at all. When he dies, there is a succession fight, which is still going on, actually. And because you cannot create a new Hasidic group with a new name, it's a sort of preservation of the brand. The names of Hasidic groups must be the towns in Eastern Europe from which they originated. Those towns have now become holy geography. And so the Satmar is now divided between two Satmar courts, two Satmar leaders, Zalman and Aharon. That movement is very much worth mentioning because of its importance, not only numerically, but also politically. It represents this very continuing extreme anti-Zionism.
Obviously, the event in Hasidic history in the 20th century is the Holocaust, and we've spoken at some length about its effects on Hasidic life and the destruction of many of the communities that existed in Europe before the war. But I would like to focus briefly on the two geographic centers that have arisen since the war, those of America and Israel, and perhaps reflect a little bit further on Satmar in the American case. Could you compare these two seats of Hasidic life, Hasidic life in America and Hasidic life in Israel?
So, you know, what's interesting is that Hasidism never really existed in a fully democratic setting. It's true that the Austro-Hungarian Empire becomes semi-democratic, and especially after 1867, the Jews are emancipated. But nevertheless, the situation that we have today since the war is entirely new. Hasidism, either in a Jewish state or in a liberal pluralistic democracy like America. And what's remarkable is that Hasidism has successfully adapted to these two different environments. In Israel, even though they don't take part centrally in the government, they have succeeded in using the Israeli welfare state very much to their benefit. The draft exemptions that Ben-Gurion issued back in the early 1950s, he thought it was only going to be 400, and now it's, you know, in the tens of thousands. And this is still a problem that Israel struggles with, but this has made it possible for these Hasidic groups to flourish in a Jewish state, a state which they don't fully recognize. In America, it's very interesting to see the way in which Hasidic groups participate in American politics. Because they vote as a bloc, they vote the way the Rebbe tells them to vote. It's incumbent on local politicians to pay their respects to the different courts and to try to curry their favor because of the votes that they can deliver. And here, too, use of the American welfare state has been very advantageous to the Hasidim. So what we see here is a movement with a remarkable ability to adapt. If it were purely a anti-modern throwback to the Middle Ages, it's unlikely they could have adapted so well to these very changed circumstances. But they have, and I think it's a example of the remarkable flexibility and ability to evolve of the Hasidic movement.
I'm sorry we don't have more time together, although we've covered much of the scope of the book, and I hope given a sense of its comprehensiveness. The volume is a treasure trove of social history and stories filled with fascinating figures and political intrigues that covers not only Hasidism, but modern Jewish history more generally. On this note, I would like to thank Professor Beal very much for joining us today on the Jewish Studies channel of the New Books Network. We've been talking about his new book, Hasidism, A New History, a collaborative effort written together with six other scholars and published in 2018 by the Princeton University Press. Thank you.